You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last weekend, the Democratic National Committee elected a new chair. In some ways, the battle for that post replicated the 2016 primary fight with a proxy battle between President Obama's Labor Secretary, Tom Perez, and enthusiastic Hillary Clinton supporter, and Keith Ellison, an early Bernie Sanders supporter and the first Muslim elected to Congress. Perez narrowly defeated Ellison, and in an effort to unite the two factions within their party, he made Ellison his deputy chair. To understand what was at stake in this fight, we are joined now by New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, author of a profile of Keith Ellison, in last week's New Yorker, under the title The Protest Candidate. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Leonard. It's such a pleasure to be on.
In the first round of balloting, Perez won 213.5 votes to 200 for Ellison. Other candidates dropped out after the first round. Did they represent a wide range of views of what's needed to rebound after this resounding defeat in the elections, the presidency, Congress, governorships, state legislatures, the like?
Well, it's interesting. Because of that proxy nature of the campaign, there was surprisingly limited difference in terms of approaches. The actual work of the DNC, the strategic work of winning back seats and eventually the presidency, they all kind of agreed on that part of it.
They also agreed that the DNC was in shambles.
Exactly right. They agreed, you know, there's been a loss of almost 1,000 seats across the country that the Democrats previously held. And so everyone kind of emphasized kind of blandly on organizing and giving power back to state parties and replicating Howard Dean's 50-state strategy. But there wasn't much, so there wasn't much difference in that way, and there wasn't either much ideological difference. It had totally become, in some ways, an instance of symbolic politics, right? Bernie versus Hillary versus Obama. All of these, this residue from the unhelpful residue had kind of
did they blame Debbie Wasserman Schultz for the mess or Donna Brazile?
The forum that I went to and all of the things that I followed during the race, there was a quiet around the name, especially of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. There was this intimation, Tom Perez, who is now the Democratic National Committee chair, at one point made a slip and said that the primary process had been rigged, as he said. Mm-hmm. And then he quickly took that back. So there was obvious acrimony over the positioning of the DNC under Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but she wasn't mentioned much by name.
But Perez's slip should have pleased the Sanders supporters, and yet, on the whole, they didn't support him. One of the candidates, Raymond Buckley, who serves as the party's chair in New Hampshire, declared, "For the last 8 years, I have been a vice chair, and I don't know what the hell is going on in this party any more than any of you."
Right.
How would that be possible?
I think that partially this is a problem of any sitting, whenever there's a sitting president of a party, that party's sort of committee structure becomes harder to maintain because all of the energy is co-opted by the president. And while I was reporting this piece, it didn't make it into the piece, but I talked to Vice President Walter Mondale, who's a wonderful man, and was talking. This happens under every president, that the president kind of loses touch with the party and cares more about himself than the rest. So I think that is definitely something that Obama's been charged with, and I think is part of that confusion that Buckley.
And I was going to ask you whether Obama bore some of the responsibility for the chaos at the DNC. Haven't you also served as a staff assistant in the White House?
Yeah, but my life before writing was I worked for the Obama campaign, and then at the DNC for a while.
Were you a witness to any of this?
There was a very strong mobilization at the moment that I was there. I was there in 2009. So all of the energy of the DNC was sort of angled toward the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And so at a moment like that, when there's very strong and clear legislative activity that is thought to also be a political boon, the party is activated and energetic. But when it's not that, in the sort of the dog days of a presidency, things can kind of can sort of fall to the side, and that's certainly not.
And of course, he also lost Congress.
Right, exactly.
In the end, Perez got 235 of the 465 mm-hmm. votes cast, but there's no question that it was a very tight race. What does that tell us about the current state of the Democratic Party?
I think that it still bespeaks a kind of confusion, at least on the level of symbols. You know, when Keith Ellison first got into the race, it was broadly seen as a concession to the Sanders wing of the party to say that, you know, the DNC chair, I don't think, is going to be some great ideological leader of the party, but it certainly is a new face and certainly someone who's going to be a steward over the party's fortunes. I think that the entrance of Perez was in some ways spoke to this chaos, and I think it kind of continues a bit.
Well, when Ellison first announced, he enjoyed the endorsements of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Chuck Schumer, Harry Reid, Chuck Schumer's predecessor. Yeah. Now, that represents a wide range of opinion within the party.
Interestingly, though,
what happened?
Yeah, interestingly, those are all senators, right? And I think that one of the big ideas in the Senate this cycle has been to bring Bernie Sanders specifically into the fold. You know, he's not a Democrat, but he was given a leadership post in the Senate Democratic Conference.
Is he dropped out of the party again and just is an independent?
Still registered as an independent. But he's still, he's got a leadership post in the Democratic caucus. And I think that's especially Schumer's endorsement of Sanders was a way to say, you know, we understand that we need you and the energy of your voters. So I think that was the reason for that wide swath within the Senate that we saw.
And Schumer also came to Ellison's defense when Ellison was accused of being anti-Semitic.
Yes. That was in some ways the great inflection point of this campaign, because that came out and there was a big sturm and drang around that, around Keith Ellison's former support of Louis Farrakhan. He was never a member of Farrakhan's Nation of Islam, but he was certainly friendly to it and to Farrakhan himself, defended him from various awful statements. And shortly after the acrimony over that, this big round of press around that, shortly after that was the entrance of Perez.
My guest is Vincent Cunningham, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker, has been there for the last year or so. He's also written about books, art, and culture for The New York Times Magazine, New York Times Book Review, Vulture, The All, The Fader, McSweeney's, where he had a column called Field Notes from Gentrified Places. We're talking about an article he wrote for the last week's issue of The New Yorker, called The Protest Candidate. When Tom Perez came into the race, it was the feeling was that he had been kind of pushed in by President Obama.
Yeah.
And Obama said afterward, "I know that Tom Perez will unite us under that banner of opportunity and lay the groundwork for a new generation of Democratic leadership for this big, bold, inclusive, dynamic America." Mm-hmm. We love so much. Why has his legacy become so controversial within the Democratic Party?
The president's?
The former president.
Exactly. Former now. I think that his ideological and sort of legislative, his substantive legacy is pretty secure. I mean, the way in which Democrats have decided to use Obamacare, as it's called, as the sort of the hinge of their opposition to Trump. I think they are very secure with his legacy, policy-wise, certainly domestically. I do think, though, that his legacy as party builder is what I think is still up for debate.
Some questioned why the Obama coalition recruited Tom Perez into the race in December. Why didn't they just let Ellison win the DNC chair, which was the expected outcome?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there was a lot of kind of Democratic insiders that are sort of close to this race, but not wanting to be on the record about it, told me that essentially there was some leftover acrimony from the primary campaign and from before. I mean, I think that the dynamic between Sanders and Obama has been kind of undersold in some way. In 2012, Sanders called for Obama to be primaried. So I think that there is some uneasiness between those factions, and I don't think they like the symbolism of Sanders being anointed as potentially the leader of the party.
But Sanders did support Hillary Clinton during the race.
She did. But I think that, by the way, I think the Perez pushed into the campaign isn't just from Obama factions. I think it's also from Clinton factions who just don't, I don't think that they wanted to see Sanders achieve that symbolic victory.
And that is reflected in the way the press described the race as being between the establishment candidate and the party's left, Ellison being the revolution candidate.
Right, right. And I think that Perez especially bristles at that, because if you look at his record, it's certainly a record of progressive achievement. And I think that, you know, in any other context, it would be kind of a joke to call him a creature of the establishment. I think he was clearly the most, the leftmost member of Obama's cabinet. There's very little difference between him and Ellison on policy. I just think that the fact that he was, I think, clearly by every account, asked to join this race by allies of Obama and Clinton are what kind of earned him that tag.
The big difference of perhaps is his support of TPP while Ellison was opposed.
Absolutely. Perez chalks that up to loyalty to the president. I think that's the way he has described that.
And some critics believe that Obama didn't promote the DNC and develop it or new talent during his time in office.
Yeah.
Do you think that's fair?
I think it's I do think it's fair. I don't know. When he has addressed these things, he has sort of cited the amount of challenges that he has had to face, and that in some ways there's a kind of zero sum nature of time. He didn't have time to deal with that. But I do
think
that
to Donald Trump, he had too much time to play golf.
Absolutely right. And now I think though he has turned his eye to that. I mean, when he spoke to the editor of my magazine, he spoke to David Remnick in a wonderful piece that David did on Obama. He talked about, he mentioned several people by name that he thought could be next generation leaders. So I think he knows that was a fault, and I think he's trying to address it.
Both Perez and Ellison refused to criticize each other, but then when Joe Biden endorsed Perez, Bernie Sanders criticized Perez. Mm-hmm. For what reason?
Well, I think this is why, even though both candidates, that is Perez and Ellison, strained very aggressively against the idea of this as a proxy battle, an instance like that shows the extent to which it was. I think Sanders said, you know, the instance of the same old politics, which was a really strong thing to say in this intra-party.
More the same old, same old.
Right, right.
But when, after the vote, Ellison supporters chanted, "Party for the people, not big money," and then they stormed out of the room, mm-hmm. How different were Perez and Ellison's platforms on key issues? You say that the main difference seems to be TPP, and that may not be an issue either.
Right, and that wasn't an issue in the campaign for the DNC chairmanship, because by the time that was being joined in earnest, Donald Trump had already dumped TPP. You know, it's not really even a thing anymore. They hewed very closely on these issues, largely because they're elected by 447 people who are Democratic insiders. So the things that you would think of that they could differ on, they kind of tended toward in one general direction over time. Issues like lobbyist money to the DNC, or the abolition of superdelegates. Those superdelegates happen all to be members of that 447, so you can imagine the difficulty there.
There's also the debate over where you get your funds during the campaign, the primaries. Of course, Bernie Sanders made a big point of the fact that most of his money was coming from small donors, mm-hmm. while Hillary Clinton's was coming from big donors, mm-hmm. and Ellison said he wanted at least one-third of fundraising for the DNC to come from small donors.
Right.
Was that just seen as unrealistic?
I think that there was a kind of agreement on that issue among the candidates, if only for kind of symbolic reasons. I think people always talk about the value of small dollar fundraising in terms of, you know, just trying to appear to be a kind of a grassroots leader. But the question was whether they could do that and at the same time abolish money from sources like lobbyists or super PACs and things like this. And at first, Ellison was very reformist on this. He said, we should not take lobbyist money. Later on in the campaign, he said, well, I would like to hear someone who would want to do that. Tell me where we're going to get the rest of the money from. That issue kind of watered itself down. Yeah.
Well, they're both members of minority groups. So mm-hmm. is the big difference that Ellison is a Muslim?
I think that his faith played a part in this campaign, following after the revelation of his comments, his friendly comments about Louis Farrakhan. But I don't think that that was, I mean, I think that the key difference between these two candidates was simply the sources of their support. I think it mattered more that Ellison was supported by Bernie Sanders and Perez by the president and his allies. I think that fact was more relevant than almost anything else.
My guess is Vincent, that's V-I-N-S-O-N, Cunningham. His latest article in The New Yorker was the protest candidate. It was in last week's issue of The New Yorker, profile of Keith Ellison and a discussion of what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Vincent Cunningham. His article, The Protest Candidate, is a profile of Keith Ellison. It was in last week's The New Yorker. And, Vincent, a lot of our sophisticated listeners have been calling in or writing in with questions and thoughts.
Sure.
One wondered, because we were talking about small donors as mm-hmm. opposed to big donors, didn't the DNC vote no on banning corporate funding?
They have not made a commitment to that ideal yet, which is weird because one of the interesting issues that came up during the course of the campaign was the proliferation of emails that the DNC sends. I don't know if you're any listeners are on these lists, but they come at an incredible pace. Can you give $5? Can you give $10? But they haven't found a way to fund, not only because, you know, their money goes to all 57 the party structures of states and territories. There are 57, and so there's an incredible funding challenge there. But I don't think they've figured out a way to do it. Possibly just because they haven't tried yet.
A caller wanted to put out the idea that having Keith Ellison as chair of the DNC might have been important, given that Trump's refugee and immigration or an immigrant executive order has also been called a Muslim ban. Mm-hmm. Don't we need a high-profile Muslim as a symbol against that kind of language?
I think that's an excellent point. And I think one of the odd features of Ellison's campaign was that he could speak uniquely, literally uniquely within the U.S. in the Congress, to the issue of Islamophobia in our culture. I think that symbolic value might be met by the fact that he's now been named deputy chair of the DNC. Which,
well, how significant is that? Remember, I quoted deputy chair who said he was a deputy chair for a long time. This is Raymond Buckley, and he says, I've been a deputy chair, and I don't know what the hell's going on in this party any more than any of you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know what it will mean, and perhaps its value will be mostly symbolic, the contents of the race were mostly symbolic. I imagine that might continue, especially in a role like this, just to have another face, and as the listener says, another person to highlight this specific part of Trump's appeal so far.
They went to dinner on Friday night before the final vote, mm-hmm. so it was must have been pretty clear that Perez was going to win.
I think that there was a weird kerfuffle right before or after that. I think right before that, where Perez's campaign came out publicly and said that they had 180 votes, which was, of course, from Ellison's perspective, perilously close to the 215 number that they would have needed. And so there was a weird a round of back and forth between the candidates, you know, Ellison's people saying that's not true and we're not going to do that, putting out a number because it will, quote, tip the scales. So I think that there was a sense that Perez was coalescing support. But as the results showed, they went to the second ballot. It wasn't cut and dried in either direction.
Ellison wasn't born a Muslim. He was born in Detroit, one of five mm-hmm. children in a Catholic family.
A Catholic family. He wasn't terribly observant, but his mother was a social worker and his father a psychiatrist, a sort of middle class upbringing in Detroit. And he However, he converted when he got to college. I think his conversion was mostly political. I think that he went to college and was helping to lead the protests against South African apartheid and leading the divestment movement on the on his campus, and through that became acquainted with Islam and specifically its social justice valences, and that was kind of what led to his conversion.
What about his conversion to thinking about becoming a politician?
Well, that came later. So I think that he was very steeped in protest all through his college and law school years. And I think the turning point for his immersion in politics was Paul Wellstone, the Minnesota senator who died tragically in a plane crash in 2002. But they had met maybe a decade before that. And Wellstone was the guy who convinced him that a person could be steeped in protest, in organizing, but also be in government and make sure that there was a continuity between those two poles, right? That the activist energy on the streets could make its way into the halls of power.
So what happened when he ran for the first time?
He ran and lost for the first time. Minnesota has a very complicated caucus system, which we see on the presidential level, but also happens on all their sort of state legislature seats. So he lost the Democratic caucus and therefore didn't get the endorsement of the Democratic Party in Minnesota. So he didn't run a primary against the person who did win that designation. And I think the first time he ran was in 1998, and he finally won a couple years later.
In a district that's 2/3 white, with the lowest turnout in the state, and now it has the highest turnout in the most recent election.
In the state, he has,
because of him.
Because I can't see another reason, and I think that he definitely gets credit for that. He, according to this Paul Wellstone model, he has in some ways used his congressional seat as a platform for organizing. So he's gone around and done things that people haven't really done there, you know, knocking doors and big public housing towers and making sure that people are engaged all the way through. So that's been a real plus on his record.
You note in your article how curious you were about why someone with Ellison's background would work so strenuously to become DNC chair. Right. Did you figure out his motivation?
You know, I think that a real turning point for him in terms of understanding the, I guess, power of procedural politics as opposed to activist politics was actually during this past campaign. He was one of the most outspoken Bernie Sanders supporters. And at the convention, people will remember that there was a lot of kind of anger from Bernie supporters and not wanting to about the way that the primary had played out. He played a big behind-the-scenes role, which I think was different for him. I think he had always been a kind of out-in-the-streets person. He played a big behind-the-scenes role in getting some of those Bernie supporters to come along to Clinton. And so this kind of unity idea, I think that lodged in his head, and I think that he thought that he could do that on the party level going forward.
He's co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Mm-hmm. Is that the left's answer to the Freedom Caucus on the right?
That is, I think, what it is supposed to be.
Was it assumed that he, as a leader, he would push that kind of brinksmanship that we have seen from the Freedom Caucus, which is really the Tea Party Republicans in Congress?
Right. Well, I think that one of the objectives of his campaign was to make it clear that that's not what he was there to do, to fight any ideological battles. But I do think that many of his supporters hoped that that is what he would have done. I think his supporters cared much more in some ways about ideology in the DNC than he did.
Well, Chuck Schumer initially announced that he would do everything he could to work with the Trump administration, mm-hmm. and now he has dropped that. Has Ellison decided that there can be no cooperation with this administration?
I think that the Democrats are confused on this issue, honestly. I think that because of Trump's ideological mismatch, it's been hard to present a total oppositional front to him. So, for example, if he says he's going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, something that you would usually associate with Democratic policy, it's hard to say, no, we won't go along.
Although Democrats are saying it depends on where that money's going to come from.
Exactly, right. And whether it's direct to people seeking jobs or whether it's to contractors and things like this. So I think that that has confused the Democrats. I think that the protests, beginning with the Women's March and continuing with the airport protests that followed the initial announcement of the so-called Muslim ban, I think that that aura and that feeling of protest energy made it easier for the Democrats to put on a more oppositional face. You saw the confirmations of cabinet nominees slow down and much more sort of combativeness there. So,
but they've all ultimately been confirmed, right, except the few who dropped out on their own right.
Yeah, the fact is that they simply don't have the votes. So in some ways, it's unfair to hope for any other outcome. However, we see now with things like the thing that's going on with Jeff Sessions right now, the questions that he was asked in those brutal rounds of questioning by the Democrats who couldn't stop his confirmation, now they're in some ways bearing fruit for the Democrats because they were so oppositional. Now they have so much on the record from these nominees. So I think it's a continuing question.
He's been accused of perjury, which would be a crime.
He has been. And I think that, for example, yesterday, Elizabeth Warren called not only for Sessions to recuse himself from the Russia matter, but also to resign. And I think that those strong calls against him, I think, are in some ways empowered by the mass protest on the left against Trump. But I still think that there is a deeper level on which they're kind of confused about how to approach.
Why do you think that the opposition, the Republican opposition, after Obama was elected and then the Tea Party opposition was so effective, and it looks like similar tactics by the Democrats, which are being dismissed by Mitch McConnell, probably won't be as effective?
Well, there's a lot there. I mean, first
is this because of the Democratic Party?
Yeah. I think it's partially ideological, which is that Democrats believe in government as a good. And therefore, Republican obstructionism can be seen as fealty to their base. We don't want to see government grow, and we don't want to see an activist government. So to shut down the government to effectively shut down the government for a period of time is a good thing. Whereas Democrats and their supporters believe that the government can be a force for good. So I think it's harder for them just on a purely ideological level to halt government in that way.
In your piece, The Increasingly Lonely Hope of Barack Obama, you covered his farewell address, and you wrote about how he tried to carry his long-running argument in favor of positive thinking.
Yeah.
Is Obama right about the power of positive thinking?
Well, I think that Obama has a strong belief still in American history as an instance of progress over time. He believes that the values that are enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, for example, will bear out over time. And I think he's being serious and being honest when he says that, sometimes things zig and they zag, this kind of thing that sometimes sounds a little milquetoast. I think he believes that. And I think that people on both the right and the left have in some ways become more fatalistic over not just here in America. I mean, we see politics in Europe, the rise of these kind of nationalist parties. I think the attitude of the time in some ways contrasts with Obama's enduring optimism, which I think is heartfelt.
And you write that Obama is out of step with much of the current thinking on racism.
Yeah.
What do you think he's missing?
I'm not sure if he's missing anything, but I certainly think that his attitude differs from I think that certainly with respect to race in the, I guess we can call it 5 years, it's almost exactly 5 years since the death of Trayvon Martin, the attitude around race has been essentially, fatalistic, that white supremacy in our country is a fixed feature of our politics, not something to be transcended. And therefore, the great necessity is to first admit that fact, and then potentially we can move on. Whereas Obama says, I think Obama's very steeped in the civil rights movement, which you know, is very that thing that he says always says, that King quote, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So I don't think he wants to dwell so much on the static nature of white supremacy as people, I think, on his left, the Black Lives Matter movement, for example.
There was a report that the president said in a small session that he wasn't sure that these attacks on Jewish community centers, or these threats against them and the destruction of the cemeteries, are really from the right. Rather, they might be some kind of a setup.
Well, I think that the president is a conspiratorial thinker, you know? I think, recently, around the same time, he said that he thought that the protests that are clearly organic and based on his policies and the things that he says were potentially organized by Obama, right? I think that he is kind of always looking for a source of trouble other than himself.
And people are being paid $2,500 to go to some of these protests.
In which case, I should stop writing and other people should.
Would that mean a raise for you at The New Yorker?
Exactly. I haven't done the math, but I think so.
What do you make of Donald Trump's tweet after the results were announced? He said, "I couldn't be happier for him," talking about Tom Perez, "or the Republican Party."
Yes. Donald Trump, I think, weirdly was attentive to this race. Before the race, he said, "I'll give it to Keith Ellison." You know, at least he thought he knew that I could win. You know, one of the funny things about Keith Ellison is that back in 2015, he went on George Stephanopoulos' show and said we should prepare for the idea of a Republican nominee Trump, and he was kind of laughed off the set. So Trump had taken note of that, and then he said, you know, what he said about Tom Perez. But I think that the elevation of any person who's in some ways sole reason for being is to resist or oppose him, I think that's the kind of thing that he in some ways relishes. So now he's got another name to sort of rail on.
What's his record been like in Congress? Has he worked well with Republicans?
This is
Ellison.
Ellison. My sense is that he has. He's not really a partisan in the sense of nasty press releases back and forth or personal vilification. I think in some ways he's much more of a 60s style liberal and an idealist first and foremost. So I think he's a collegial guy.
Have you spoken to him since the election last weekend?
I have not. I did try, but I don't think his campaign didn't seem eager to to continue to talk about it.
You know? What about others who worked with him? What did they say?
I think they just—they really believed until the end that he could win. I think that's the sense that I got from the folks on his side that I talked to. That after that first ballot, they thought that part of the game of this is that once between ballots, some other candidates then exit the race and either endorse or don't. Mm-hmm. And so there was one of the other candidates, Sally Boynton Brown, another state party leader. Got out, and they thought that that Ellison would get her 12 votes. The mayor of South Bend, Indiana, this young upstart, Pete Buttigieg, who was endorsed by Howard Dean and had gotten out of the race before even the first ballot, they not only thought that he would endorse Ellison, they sent out a text that he had endorsed Ellison, which later turned out to be untrue within the sort of voting room, and that created a minor kerfuffle. But so they thought that the exit of these other candidates would help them win on the second ballot.
Many of those votes went to Tom Perez instead.
A lot of them did, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show to talk about all of this.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Vincent Cunningham, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, also has written. Do you still do the column for McSweeney's?
I don't, but it was a lot of fun to do.
Field Notes from Gentrified Places. You'll find his writing all over the place in the New York Times Magazine, New York Times Book Review, and elsewhere. We've been talking about his piece in last week's New Yorker called The Protest Candidate. Thank you so much for being on our
Thanks,
show.
Thanks, Leonard. Appreciate it.